Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Welcome everyone to your weekly delivery of Owl Post. I am one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and with me, the wonderful, the talented, the fantastic, Drea Kaufman.
Hello everyone.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
You know what? I'm super excited to be here because I've never said this before on the show. I love this chapter.
I know, right? Newsflash, I love this chapter.
This just in. He loves the chapter. Oh, gosh.
Every week it's like, wait, this one's my favorite chapter. No, this one's my favorite chapter.
No, this one. This. No.
They're just all my favorite chapters.
I love them all. They are all my children. And no, that's another show. Anyway, so what's great about this chapter, though, is we're at the journey to platform 9 3/4, okay? But you know what? Before we dive into that, we have some serious thank yous to give because we got some brand new iTunes reviews, Drea, and we need to make sure that those people get thanked first and foremost. So everybody hold on to your hats. We're going to do that now. Make sure that, you know, your wizarding hats don't fly off. Your top hats, be careful. We got a great new review from DJ Hunt. Said, begins again, 5 stars. You know, one thing he said that he would like to see a little listener feedback at the beginning or the end of every episode. Well, here you go, DJ. There is your listener feedback. Thank you so much for your review. And I love that idea. But you know what that means?
We need listeners to provide feedback.
Exactly. We do.
Yay! Gold star.
Yay! 5 points for Gryffindor.
5 points.
Yeah.
For Gryffindor.
Well, yeah, Gryffindor. I mean, for Ravenclaw. I can't remember. So if you would love us to talk about some of your feedback on the chapters that we're reading, we'd love to do that at the end or the beginning of the episodes. So to do that, you'd want to go to Twitter at @JoinNerdParty. You can also go to our website and you go to thenerdparty.com/contact. You'll choose Owl Post is the show, and you can write us a message, and it'll come to us, and then we can talk about it, which would be fun. You can also leave your feedback like DJ did on iTunes reviews. We'd really appreciate that, the fact that we hadn't had any of that, but he still gave us 5 stars, so really, thank you so much, DJ. I'm not sure if you're a him or a her or a centaur, so I'm not sure what pronoun would be best, but thank you for your review. We really appreciate it. Emily Reed said, your weekly Owl Post, 5 stars, and she said that she's thrilled to be listening to this new addition to the Nerd Party Network and is a longtime fan of the Harry Potter books. And, well, you're in good company, Emily, because so are we. So,
yay!
Yeah. But yes, please, one last place you can leave some feedback is on Facebook at our Facebook group. Right there, you don't even have to join or anything. You can just find the page and like us. It's Facebook.com/TheNerdParty. And we post all of our episodes there as well. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can do that easily on Facebook under the episodes. And we could use some of that in our show. So, whew, man. Really appreciate that, Coke, because it's helping the show grow and it's helping more people find us. So continue to give us those star ratings and reviews, and we'll continue to make sure you get a shout out on the show. And it helps other fans find it as well.
All of that.
All of those things. Mm-hmm. Now, it's really interesting diving into this chapter because we are finally going to start that journey. You know, Harry is finally going to get to leave the Dursleys' house, and that is wonderful. But you know what? I thought it was really interesting, and the chapter starts off with him getting the silent treatment, and I'm not sure which is worse, getting tortured by everybody and then, you know, talking down to you all the time, or them just not talking to you and pretending like you don't exist.
I thought it was interesting that he pointed out that at first he thought it was really great that they just were sort of leaving him alone. And then after a while, it got to be sort of depressing for people to treat you like you literally don't exist. So, I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's personal preference. I think it would wear on me. I think I would want people to acknowledge that I exist at some point. Because at least when you're yelling at me and torturing me, at least I'm there. I matter something to you. So,
no, I think you're exactly right. And it seems to me that in a lot of ways, this is their way of showing just how little Harry matters to them at all. And that, you know, just when you thought that the Dursleys couldn't get worse, they go and do something like this and totally make themselves worse. So it is really the psychological almost torture that he's under is just awful, you know? And so I was really struck by that at the very beginning. I mean, that's legitimately the very first thing that happens in the chapter that Harry's talking about, how his last month with the Dursleys is this silent treatment. And wow. Partly, too, I do like that is that in there, that they're scared of him, and Harry can tell that.
Yes.
there is that. But you also have to think, too, this is not a defense of the Dursleys, but for them, the world in which they have created has come crumbling down. You know, they don't...
Everything they've held true is being challenged, and that's a real... If you don't rise to the occasion, it's kind of like that Doctor Who quote from John Hurt, where it was like, great men are forged in the fire of war. Like, they're thrown into the deep end and forced to face the very thing that they are most afraid of in all of the world, and how they react is a true depiction of their character. And in this case, I think that we really saw how afraid and weak they are as people.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because... I mean, when you think about it like this, the Dursleys are said to be the most normal of normals, and they don't want anything beyond what they consider to be normal. And so this elseworld, this other world comes crashing into theirs, the one that they've been spending their whole lives denying. And interestingly, I think of it in a spiritual sense. I mean, like, they've been confronted by something and they don't want to believe it, and so they've put the blinders on, like, and because Harry's there, he's the literal representation of everything they don't want to believe in. And he's in their kitchen eating their food at breakfast, and, you know, in his bedroom, but they don't want to see it, you know. And I think that's really interesting, because throughout the series, and by the end of the series, Rowling plays with a lot of big moral ideas, spiritual and metaphysical ideas. And so that's interesting, because I see that playing out in this chapter. And it's very subtle, but it is very interesting when you start to think about, you know, these two worlds that are colliding, and they're just trying their best to pretend like it still doesn't exist, even though it's in their kitchen.
It's really interesting to see how sort of Harry handles that too, right? He now knows a little bit more about why the Dursleys treat him the way they do. And mm-hmm. He had every opportunity to sort of lash out and almost do a Tom Riddle, Voldemort sort of rebel, right? Like, okay, fine, you're afraid of me. I'll give you a reason to be afraid of me. But instead, he sort of just keeps to himself. He only approaches Uncle Vernon when he has to. You know, he's still afraid they're going to say no, and he's not going to know what he's going to do if they won't give him a ride to London. Like, he took it in this very, like, humble sort of way of, I have this great power, but I'm not going to do anything with it. So,
and you know, the thing that I forgot, too, is that Harry spends his time reading his school books.
Yeah. I forgot that too.
You know, like, that's not something that we get in the movies, that Harry's a bookish type at all. You know, he's always kind of seen to be like more like the brawn than the brains. But I loved the fact that he was devouring all he could about this world. You know, Hagrid had opened up the door for him, and now he wants as much of it as possible. Yeah. And that's going to be actually a theme in this chapter, about how Harry just feels inadequate compared to all of the other people, even muggles coming in like Hermione, because she knows all about him. She's read even more books, you know, and she knows these things about Harry that he doesn't even know, you know, and it bothers him, and he just basically feels inadequate. You know, he even says that to Ron, and Ron's like, it's fine. Plenty of muggles come in to, you know, Hogwarts, and they learn just fine. You know, he's like, it's okay, bro. Just chill out.
Harry is experiencing what every woman in the workplace experiences, and probably lots of men too, but the quintessential imposter syndrome, where he feels like he doesn't actually deserve all these accolades, and one day everyone's going to wake up and they're going to look at him and be like, wait, why did we make such a big deal out of you? You're no big deal. Like, you're nothing. You can't even do magic. You don't even know everything about yourself, let alone everything about the wizarding world. So that is very, very apparent in this chapter, where he's totally not sold on the fact that he's anything special.
And it's so interesting too, because, you know, once Harry gets to King's Cross Station, he doesn't want to ask anybody. He doesn't want to seem like he's out of place. And thankfully, I don't know if it's the will of the Force or magic or whatever that brings the Weasley family at that right moment to come around the corner. But one of the things that I really love is that Harry's world is being opened up to a whole new world, a whole new reality, a whole new sense of being. And that happened when, obviously, Hagrid told him, you know, Harry, you're a wizard. And then, of course, he gets his wand. And now he's at this place. And you know, Harry hasn't really, he's never done magic on purpose. You know, he's still having to accept all these things that people are telling him. And one of my favorite things is kind of watching him take that first leap of faith, which is going through the platform at 9 3/4. That works. Like, you know, I thought that was really interesting, because there's going to be a lot of things that throughout the series, Harry kind of has to take on the word of other people and trust other people and take on faith, you know, until he tries it, and then he can do it. Or he learns it and knows that to be true. And I loved that, because I don't know what's more scary about being in a really crowded place with your trolley and you've got your owl there and everything, and you're running at a wall, and the thought that you could look like an idiot in front of everybody and crash, and you're taking the word of a person that you don't know. I just really liked seeing, you know, Harry's first act of faith in something he can't see, you know, because there's going to be a lot of things that Harry has to take on faith later on, specifically that he just can't see, and he has to trust that he's been told the right thing, or that he believes the right thing.
Yeah, it's true. I think the platform 9 3/4 was one of my favorite magical elements that she does. I think a lot of them are great, but that one, for some reason, is just always, it's so ingenious. It's so smart. I have no idea where she came up with it, and I love it.
No, I wish that I knew too. Like, maybe if we tweeted her on Twitter, she might answer. The other thing that was really interesting here is, obviously, we get to meet the Weasleys. Mm-hmm. And I'm immediately struck how much it must suck. That's right, that rhymed. For Ron to be the youngest boy.
He is the most gracious 11-year-old I've ever met in my entire life. Like, he was like, oh, you know, it sucks that I get all my hand-me-downs. But you know what? They do their best. Like, oh, she doesn't remember that I don't like corned beef. But like, she, you know, she's got 5 mouths to feed. Like, every time he finds himself complaining, he always goes back and gives his mom the benefit of the doubt. Like, that was just so drilled into him. And it was like, he was the most, I don't even know the word I'm looking for. He was just...
There is a sense in him, and this is where I say it would suck to be him, because he even says to Harry, look, I've got, you know, 5 other brothers, and so if I do anything, they've already done it. So even if I do well, all of my other brothers have done that already. He has this inferiority complex.
Uh-huh.
What's so interesting is Harry has the exact same inferiority complex. And that's what brings those two people together, because I think they realize how similar they are. They come from very different worlds and they have different situations, but they have the same mental issues, basically. Like, they have the same things that bother them about themselves. And I think that that brings them together. And obviously, as we move forward, they're going to grow up a little bit differently and still have different issues. But here, I loved how Ron feeling like, it doesn't really matter what I do because nobody really cares about me because I'm the last boy and nothing I can do is going to be spectacular. Well, Harry kind of feels the same way because, you know, it's not like he's going to be writing home to the Dursleys about what he did in school because they're not going to care.
Yeah, it's really an interesting relationship you just see organically grow, and you see Harry instantly recognizes the good in the whole Weasley family, you know, with George and Fred helping him get his trunk stored and, you know, Molly helping him get through the wall, and then him overhearing, you know, Fred and George go back and tell Mrs. Weasley, like, oh my gosh, you won't believe who that boy was. And her being like, you leave him alone. Like, so motherly, just right off the bat. And they didn't know he could hear. She could have been like, ooh, figure it out. Or that's really interesting or something. And no, she was like, no, you leave him alone. He's got enough to worry about. So it was really nice to have him kind of overhear that and to have him reminded that there really are good people in the world still. Because if you consider the fact that besides Hagrid and Mrs. Flitwick or whatever across the street.
Miss Fig.
He's never really met good people before.
And I think you nailed it right on the head. One of the most fun things about this is that immediately, I mean, Miss Weasley has not even met Harry Potter yet. For more than like what, 3 seconds where she explains how to get through the wall.
Yeah.
But she is already stepped in to be his surrogate mother. She didn't know his situation. She doesn't know what it's like for him at home.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one of the things that I love about this chapter is it sets up immediately that this is going to be the family that Harry always wanted. You know, because Fred and George kind of accept him immediately. Ron accepts him immediately. Miss Weasley already loves him. Of course, Ginny wants to go see him, you know, and that's just going to turn into something awesome. Hint, hint, wink, wink. And
spoilers!
Spoilers. And I was just immediately struck with love for Mrs. Weasley when she's like, I forbid you to ask him, Fred. You can just hear her, you know? And he's like, don't you dare, as if he needs reminding of that his first day at school. I mean, it's classic mother and it's wonderful. And I think it's the thing, Harry hearing that, I think cements for him, this is what I want to be a part of. Like, this is what I've been missing. And I don't know, it's just so... I almost wish that there was an internal scene in his head at this point of something going on, like, or the fact that there's tears in his eyes, but he doesn't know why, you know, because he's being treated really well for the first time in his life. It's awesome.
Which I want to emphasize that it's amazing to think about experiencing that for the first time at 11. Like, it still is a little tugs on the heartstrings to think about the fact that this is the first time he's sort of interacting with decent people. Everyone else has been okay to him. I mean, we're not even talking they've been anything over and above to him. We're just talking basic human decency, respect his privacy, honor who he is, that he's a person, and remember that. That's all she really asks of them. And like, this is the kindest anyone has ever been to him. And it's baffling that anybody has to go through life like that. It breaks my heart.
Well, and it sets up, and we'll jump to the end even though we're not there yet, but it sets up why there's the dichotomy between who Harry chooses to be friends with and who he doesn't, because Malfoy never treats him right. You know, even from the moment they met and Madame Malkin's, they didn't know who each other were, really. They just, you know, he just knew that Malfoy is a snotty little boy that reminded him of Dudley, and that's not what he wanted to be around. And it's like, it's just so true. If you want people to like you, you got to be nice to them. If you want them to join your side, you know, you catch more flies with honey. Malfoy and his uppity attitude aren't helping him win friends and influence people. You know, nobody likes
trademark.
Yeah, just let's trademark that.
No, that's already trademarked. That's a book.
Oh, I mean, that is trademarked statement in a book. I apologize. My bad. Don't sue me.
We're not referencing the book.
Just saying, go read that book. It's
actually a great book.
Yeah. But, you know, I think that is a really interesting thing that she does in the chapter, because the way that he is treated with the Weasleys, it is everything he needs to know that, okay, there are nice people in this world, there are not nice people in this world, and guess what? I don't have to choose to be with not nice people anymore.
It was really interesting, too, because Harry was able to sort of speak to Ron, I think, on a whole level, not just from sort of this feeling of inferiority, but he was able to really talk to him in a way that, like, hey, I'll trade you my chocolate frog for your sandwich. And he's like, oh, you don't want it. But somehow he's still kind of convinced Ron. Like, he was able to sort of, I don't want to say manipulate, but massage Ron's pride throughout all this, too. Because someone like Ron he recognized he didn't have a lot of it right now. He was the last boy, you know, he's got hand-me-down everything. He has to walk in these footsteps. And the last thing that he needs is to get even more of an inferiority complex. So Harry was even able to sort of navigate that in a very mature way for someone his age. So I thought that was really, it was really big of him. And it was really a nice, you know, like a nice relationship that already kind of got started. It was a really interesting part. It was very, I remember looking like that was very mature of Harry already.
Well, and the way that he does it is by saying, dude, I'm no different than you are. I mean, I grew up the exact same way. I had hand-me-down clothes. I lived in a cupboard. I didn't even know I had money until a month ago. I mean, I've never had proper birthday presents. You know, all the stuff that you have, Ron, like, that's all hand-me-down and, like, it's not really yours. That's been my life. The struggle is real. I get it. You know?
Yeah, you may think that I'm this, like, really famous person, but I've been wearing my cousin's hand-me-downs for my entire life. So, you know, don't worry too much about it.
Yeah, he's like, these are the first trainers I've had that fit, okay? You know? Yeah. It's my guess. You know, I feel like this is the first time that Harry's ever worn clothes that fit him, you know? Yes. And
this is the first time he's bought a ton of candy off a trolley, yeah, which is exactly every kid's dream. It's every adult dream. I bet my husband's like, man, I wish I could just go shopping in the candy store right now.
Well, and I think that's the thing that's really neat, too, is because it leads into Harry being able to share his fears of saying, you know, oh, you know, Ron's like, oh, you use Voldemort's name. He's like, I'm not trying to be brave or anything. This is my problem. I don't even know what I don't know.
Yeah. I didn't even know any better.
Yeah. And he's like, this is where that Harry and Ron find the ability. And this is what is actually kind of cool about this. It's a male friendship where it's okay to be vulnerable with each other and share their pain, you know, like what's really going on. I think that's a great lesson for boys. It's okay to talk about your feelings, you know, with other dudes.
I'm sort of nodding furiously again over here.
You know, it's totally okay. You might not want to share that with everyone, but it's okay for you and another guy to sit around and talk about, man, this is how I feel about this, and I don't like it, you know, and to get that off your chest. And that's so cool that that's what they do in this chapter. And I think that's what leads them to being such fast friends so quickly, because they're willing, and they don't really necessarily know any better because they're 11, that vulnerability is actually going to lead to a very deep friendship very quickly. And I think that's pretty awesome. So it's something that really should be celebrated about the chapter in this book and just Rowling's writing in general, is that I think she does a wonderful job of portraying friendship, which is so important, you know. And it's not just romantic relationships, you know, but friendship, like real friendship. And I think that's really beautiful. And so, and yeah, I do love that Ron and him just eat like mad because they've got to get sick. But
oh my God, I would get so sick.
My favorite thing, though, and I love that Rowling does this all the time. She drops the fact that he gets the Albus Dumbledore card from his chocolate frog. You read the information that you need. But you know what? If you're reading this for the first time, you probably dismiss it because it's the back of a bubblegum card. And that's what we're thinking in our heads is muggles. Like, it doesn't really matter. It's not important. And I don't know about you, but did you pick up on this the first time that you read it and think back like, oh, okay, so you're smarter than I am? It's not surprising.
I did, but you have to remember I'm an investigator for a living. So like that kind of stuff is like what I'm kind of trained to pick up on. So I think the first time it came up later, I was like, oh, I remember. Go back a few chapters. So, but I'm in the minority on that for sure.
And it's so cool that she does that. I mean, I think it's one of the hallmarks of Rowling's writing is that she has this ability to drop in the most innocuous things that actually become the most important things later on. And so I really love that.
Also, apparently people in the Muggle world sit still in pictures.
Yeah, that's so weird.
Just to be clear.
Yeah, that is awkward. I mean, unless you have those like moving pictures on the new iPhone, but those hadn't been invented yet. So,
but then they just cycle back. They're still there though.
Yes. I have to say, Hermione does not come off well in her introduction. But what I love about it is that she is very much a classic bossy 11-year-old girl. And my sister was one of these people. So it's not sexist or anything. Like, it just exists and it's a thing and she grows out of it. But I kind of love her for it in the book because she's just unapologetically
oblivious.
Yes.
So unapologetically yes. Oblivious. She just is who she is. And has no idea that this is super annoying to everybody else.
Well, and she won't until Ron speaks about her in a snotty way later on in the book. But that's a whole other chapter. So, but I do love that she's the one who kind of amps up what Harry doesn't know about himself by talking about how he's in all of these books about, you know, modern magical history and the rise and fall of the Dark Arts, great wizarding events of the 20th century. And Harry is just like, mind is being blown like over and over again. He's like, I didn't know. And she's like, oh, well, that's weird because I would have gone and read everything, you know, like way to make him feel better, Hermione.
Thanks for that. But then again, he also, I mean, that's again one of those, like, he didn't know what he didn't know. He wouldn't have known right. To go look, that he could have even gone and looked himself up, because if he did, then he probably would have.
No, I mean, absolutely not. It's just, it's one of the craziest things about the story. Now, what's really interesting here as well is we get a further structuring of this foundational myth that underlies the wizarding world. And it has all to do with Gryffindor and Slytherin and the sides in which that creates, you know, because there's this demarcation line between those two. And it permeates everything in the story, the Slytherin-Gryffindor divide. And what's so interesting about it is that the only thing that's going to bring that together in the end, spoiler alert, is Harry. Because Harry is both of those. He's Gryffindor and he's Slytherin at the same time. Of course, he doesn't
know
it right
now.
Way to
ruin the next chapter for everybody, dude.
But, you know, it really has been striking me how much the foundation of Hogwarts affected the wizarding world by those four different people creating those houses, but it was the fight between Gryffindor and Slytherin that defines the wizarding world. Apparently for the next, you know, 1,500 years. So and how that perpetuates itself, because, you know, the last thing Ron wants to be is in Slytherin, you know?
Yep.
And it's an interesting way of looking about how those, there's really no better word for it, but prejudices get passed down.
Yeah, and you also sort of got a little another taste of the sort of pure blood versus non-pure blood on the Weasley side when, you know, Ron asks him like, oh, well, is your mom and dad, are they both, you know, wizards or whatever? And he was like, yeah, we have one second cousin on my mom's side, but we don't talk to him. He's an accountant and we don't talk to him or something like that. And it was kind of that first time where we touch on that sort of ignorant racism, for lack of a better word, ignorant prejudice that Ron has been instilled with. Even though it's coming from a place that's generally good, it's still there. And that's sort of that first little taste you get from Ron about that.
No, you're absolutely right. And it goes back to the wizarding world hiding itself because of all the bad things that have been done to it. And yeah, that perpetuates itself. And what Rowling is so good at doing is definitely showing the ways in which the things in the world that, you know, the structures that we have, the foundations that we have for the world and our belief systems and all that continue going on, because sometimes maybe they're just not challenged or rethought or any of those things. And, you know, sometimes you can still challenge something and it should stay up. You know, I mean, it should stay a principle that we hold to. Sometimes it should fall. It just depends. But the being afraid of that challenge is definitely not what we should be about. You know, honestly, the best way to sharpen what you believe is to talk to somebody who doesn't agree with you.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you refine your arguments. It makes you think deeply about them and understand them in a way you wouldn't know before, because you're trying to explain them to somebody who doesn't agree with you, and vice versa. And that leads to also understanding.
And it really teaches you to respect that other people are going to hold opinions that are contrary to yours, and really challenges you to broaden that horizon of how much am I, you know, how different in my own life and in my own tribe. There's diversity and then there's like adversity. Where's that line for you, right? Like, where does having friends with differing opinions become just differing opinions, and when does it become actually like being challenged? So, you know, I have friends with very different opinions from myself, but, you know, we respect the opinions of the other and we will discuss them, but we don't ever challenge each other about them. There's no aggression behind them. But so it's sort of that, you know, that idea that you should always sort of be pushing yourself a little bit in that perspective. And I think she definitely does that to all her characters throughout the book. And this is sort of the first opportunity for you to see the two or three ways that she's really going to challenge Ron going forward.
Well, and all of the characters in the end, the main characters are going to kind of have some sort of coming to Merlin moment. I
like it.
You know, it's kind of like a coming to Jesus moment, a coming to Harry moment. Let's call it that. Because they're are going to be confronted by a lot of things, and they're going to have to figure out, okay, what are the things that I'm willing, what can we let go of, what needs to be discussed, and what's the hill that we need to die on, you know? Because, and let's just be honest, in the world we live in today, too many people are dying on hills that don't need to be died on, and we kind of miss the real hills.
The point.
Yeah. And so that's something that's going to happen for a lot of the characters in the story as they all kind of get refined, you know, and there's a sense of a story of redemption for a lot of these different characters from these different prejudices, which I think is really interesting as their characters get refined and they become better people. And so that's one of the cool things about Harry too, is because he's kind of an outcast, he's more willing to be with the outcasts, you know, and listen to them, and he identifies with them more.
Well, and more we're going to see Harry's role as it comes to play as that outsider, challenging things that and questioning things from a very genuine perspective that haven't been questioned in a long time. you know, it'll inspire other people to do that as well. Other characters will start to question the way things are working because they don't work anymore. He really is going to drive social change in the environment. And it's kind of the first opportunity where he starts, you know, kind of standing up to Malfoy. It's sort of the first time he stands up to himself and sort of says, no, I'm going to do this differently. I got a second chance to live my life in a different way, and I'm going to take it. I'm going to do something with it. And I'm going to take anybody who wants to come with me along for the ride. So, you know, like, he calls Voldemort by name, and Ron freaks out, and he's like, I didn't know you weren't supposed to do that. And right. Ron's like, well, I don't know why we don't do that, but we don't do that. And you're like, okay, well, why don't we do that? Like,
I don't
get it, but okay. You know, and it really challenges Ron right away to think, like, why don't we do that? That's weird. And later we'll find out why you don't do that. But there's a real reason why you don't do that. But, you know, right now it's like, well, we've just always never done that. So mm-hmm. that's just how it works. And he's like, well, that doesn't work for me. Okay, that's fine. I'm not going to fight this battle.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. It really, it reminds me of the story of the Nativity. You know, and we just had Christmas not too long ago. So if you've ever read the story, you know, the angels appear to shepherds. And most people don't understand what that means. But in that time period, shepherds were outcasts, like not people that you would tell anything to. They were thought of as thieves and like people you just wouldn't want to hang out with. I mean, they're weird. They hang out on, you know, hills with sheep all the time. And they're but those are the first people that got appeared to about the coming of Jesus. And so it just is interesting that the same thing kind of happens with Harry. Like, he immediately is surrounding himself with people that everybody else in the wizarding world considers outcasts, like Hagrid. I mean, Malfoy even calls that out. You know, you keep hanging around people like that Hagrid, that giant, or, you know, the Weasleys. You know, it's not going to end well for you. In fact, it'll probably end just like it did for your parents. Like, talk about snotty little brat. But, I mean, it's a very interesting thing that immediately Harry has chosen his side. And I love that that's really going to have huge implications, like you were saying, for the wizarding world as we challenge a lot of things that we just haven't talked about in the wizarding world for a long time. So, gosh, we went on about that a long time, but, you know, it's a big chapter. We weren't lying. There's a lot in this chapter because I totally forgot that this is in the chapter. They reveal the mystery. Like, they set out the mystery that the kids are going to be flummoxed by the whole time, which is about what got stolen from the vault. And we learn all of that here. I love it. It's just awesome.
Yeah, I can say it totally. This, so basically, after Hagrid gives Harry his letter, everything from there is different in the movie as it is from the book. I mean, same basic elements get played out. We still learn all the same information, but it definitely happens in a different way. There's no going back to the Dursleys and then going back to the train. There's no, they meet Hermione only once on the train in the movie. They meet her multiple times here. She's way more ornery in the book than she is in the movie. You get more of an insight into Scabbers. Scabbers definitely has more personality in this chapter. You learn about Voldemort. You learn about a lot more about the wizarding world and about the Weasleys. And you learn about the break-in at Gringotts already, which in the movie you don't learn until someone's reading the newspaper and we find out. So, I mean, it's all jumbled in a different place. But in this chapter, we basically get the first, like, half an hour of the movie. Or at least a half an hour of the movie.
Yes, you're exactly right. This chapter, if you did it all in the movie, could be a whole episode of, like, an hour-long TV show. I mean, just because there's so much stuff in it. And I would say that the first two movies are probably the best in following the storylines and really giving you the most of the storylines that you get in any of the films. But it is phenomenal to be rereading this and be kind of blown away by just how much more there still is. And I think that that's really interesting. And it's a lot more fun because there's just so much more to dive into. And so I we got to get to the fact that there's the big showdown between Crab, Goyle, Malfoy, and Harry and Ron.
In which Scabbers saves the day.
Exactly. Which is so funny when you think later on. But apparently Wormtail here doesn't like the Malfoys either.
I know. It's like his own personal form of revenge. It's so great.
It is. It is. And you don't get that unless you've read the other books. And it's phenomenal.
You can't appreciate it until you've made it through at least book three.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it really is wonderful to see.
To think about it. You're just like, hilarious.
It's incredible writing. And I have to say that I love that Harry does, he makes that stand. He's like, I think I can tell the wrong sort for myself, thanks. And I think it's pretty incredible because you really are diving in again into that dichotomy between Gryffindor and Slytherin and the beliefs that they hold. Because, once they do leave, Ron and him talk about the Malfoy family and how that they were some of the first to come back after Voldemort disappears. You know
and
who.
And they didn't believe him.
Right. But what I love about the way it's set up is that I think that she does a good job of just showing that the Malfoys are really just opportunists. They're not true believers. They just want to be in power, and they think that the belief system of Voldemort is what's going to give them power.
And it's the easiest.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the easiest. It's the path of least resistance, right? Like, it's easier for them to go along with this evil force that is, permeating versus trying to fight it or potentially stand in the way, especially when at that point sort of a neutral stance didn't exist, that the easiest thing to do is just to follow in those footsteps, and that's how they're going to be the most valued and they're going to have the least, things in their way.
What I like about it is the way in which it mirrors real life, because that's exactly what happens in the real world. We take the least form of resistance because we feel like it's going to give us the most amount of benefit a lot of times. And, the reason that it's a cliche, but it's totally true, is that anything worth having in life is usually probably hard to get. I mean, if you've ever been married, you understand what that means. If you've ever gotten an advanced degree, you know what that means. I just take all the things that we do in life that are difficult, but they end up being rewarding in the end. They're usually really hard to do. And so, it is that kind of thing where, like, the might makes right power argument is what the Malfoys are making. And, it's easy as a wizard to lord yourself over people like Muggles. And not have to actually deal with them as people. And that's one of the things that I think is very interesting. She deals with that idea of Muggles being called Muggles by the wizarding world. Or, well, I guess if you're in America, they're no mages, but that's a whole other series. What's fascinating, though, is that word is used as a way to dehumanize in the wizarding world. For a lot of witches and wizards, it's a way to make them seem less than human. And I like that she introduces the idea that the labels that we put on people allow us to treat them certain ways without us even consciously thinking about it. And how dangerous that is. And it's a word as common as the word Muggle. And it's good people use it too in the series, but they don't necessarily always understand what that's like, to, you know, or maybe how by doing that it could be harmful, you know. And so it is true, words do matter because they have the power to change in our brains the way we think about people. You know, if I call you a liberal or a conservative or a Democrat or a Republican, or, I mean, the list goes on and on, gay, straight, whatever you want to say, you immediately get to put on somebody something that it might not be true just with a word. And so I like that she is calling that out. I think it's pretty awesome.
This is the first time. So the only other thing that really happens in this chapter that we haven't talked about is this is the first time we meet Hogwarts. Like, this is the first time we ever see the castle, and she does not paint a huge picture. Like, it's painted there, but it's nothing like the movie where the actual visual reveal happens. And I think it's fine. I mean, she's describing a castle, so I don't know how much majesty she can paint it and how much we can really know about it right away. But, you know, she describes almost the journey to the castle more than the actual castle. You know, they have to get in these boats, and she's very specific on the number of kids who can get in each boat and who got in the boat, and like that they had to hide their heads as they rolled under some ivy and like all this stuff. So it was a big point. I mean, I always think of Hogwarts as a character, and so this was the introduction of yet another major character in the whole series. So that was a pretty big thing that happened in this book, and it only happened in like a page. One page.
Well, and it's interesting because the way that it's introduced is what the kids see, which is that, you know, perched on the other side of the lake on a high mountain is this small city on a hill, yep. You know, with shining lights. And that definitely has some biblical references to it. You know, the city on a hill cannot be hidden, although this one can by magic. But I love the way that that's introduced because she paints a picture, but it's not an overly expressive picture and tons of description. It just gives you enough for you to be able to put yourself in that mindset. And if you hadn't seen the movie yet, you get to make up whatever you want. And I think that's important. She'll explain a lot more about the castle later because it is going to be a hugely important part of her story. But here, it's just meant to be that kind of thing. Like, it's so glorious, it's hard for them to take in, you know? Like, and I think I was actually feeling that feeling of them getting in the boats and looking up at the castle. And I was just like, I was feeling it, you know? And I'm playing that scene from the movie, obviously, too. Yep. And with the music and everything. And it just, oh, it's swelling and it's beautiful. And I was like, can I just go there? I want to go to there.
I want to get into boat.
Yes.
Oh. I bet Tristan and the girl would get in the boat with us and we could all go to Hogwarts.
Totally. Let's do it. The last thing that I think is interesting is that we meet Neville for the first time. And of course, you know, he's lost his toad. But what I love is that Harry and Ron are nice to him. So is Hagrid. Who's like, you still have your toad at the end, you know? Like,
is this the thing you were looking for?
Yeah. So, it's just a subtle thing, but it's important. The people that we meet in this chapter on the way to Hogwarts, you know, we meet Ron, the Weasley mm-hmm. family, Hermione, Malfoy and his gang, and Neville. And those are the important people, and those are the people who are going to be the biggest players in the rest of the series. And
well, in this book, because we also meet George and Fred and
true.
Molly
right.
and Ginny, yeah. who also all are very important as mm-hmm. well. And interestingly enough, we briefly meet Neville's grandmother, who kind of comes into play a little bit later when we learn more about Neville's family.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So this is one of those chapters where I'm blown away because what unfortunately happens with a series like this that's been, you know, made into a movie is what I remember tends to be the movie. What I'm loving about going through this series like this with you, Drea, is that I'm really digging in to this story this way, and I'm remembering this now. Like, this is overwriting those movie memories, and the movie is just becoming the thing that adds wonderful scenes to explain certain parts and fill in, like, visual aids and music. But what's coming alive is the story of the book. And I'm so excited to continue on with this with you. And it's just, it's so much fun. So, we talked so much on this episode. We would love to have your feedback. So, again, find us on Twitter, at Join Nerd Party, or another great place, Facebook, facebook.com/TheNerdParty, or thenerdparty.com/contact, and choose the outpost. We'd love to hear what you have to say. Now, Drea, if, you know, maybe some listeners would like to catch up with you on the interwebs, Acromantula interwebs, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at PCFChick, which actually, from earlier in our episode, DJ, who gave us a nice review on iTunes, has also already given me some comments on Twitter. So thank you for that. I actually do really appreciate that. And then on Instagram, you can also find me at Drea Kaufman, and it's COFFMAN.
Well, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. I'm also on Instagram at MRushing. I'm over on a network called Trek FM, where I'm doing a couple of shows. I do the 602 Club, which is our general geek show. So check that out. It's a lot of fun. We have covered all the Harry Potter movies there, as well as so many other fandoms that we love. So I hope you will. You can also find Star Wars, the 602 Club collection. Both of those are on iTunes. I think if you like this show, you're going to love those shows. And I also do a show there with my good friend Chris Jones, where we talk about Deep Space Nine, and it's called The Orb. Now, here on the Nerd Party Network, I'm also doing Aggressive Negotiations. That's with John Mills, and we talk specifically about Star Wars. It is a lot of fun. I mean, we just pick sometimes very random topics, sometimes very purposeful topics, serious, fun, silly, all sorts of things. So make sure you check it out. We just did our 50th episode and not too long ago, and we did our commentary for Star Wars New Hope. So I hope you'll check it out.
So thank you all for checking your owl post.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.